Love one another and be happy. It's as simple and as difficult as that. In the theology of John's community, the group that gave us the fourth, or John's Gospel, love is the central word. Indeed, the first letter of John says, God is love. It's a love that gives of itself, is hospitable, generous, accommodates difference, and upsets those who like clear boundaries. It's a free and disturbing spirit. Personally, I discover this love all around us, in acts of inclusion, in acts of selfless giving, and in acts of making room for dissent. It's in these actions that I experience God. If, however, love and love alone is our guide and goal as a church, what status do the received traditions and biblical laws have? If revered traditions and laws don't measure up to what love demands, are they to be ignored or discarded? St. Paul made love so central to his understanding of the gospel that he took license to set aside even biblical laws when new cultural contexts made them inappropriate. These are questions that are as current today as they were in biblical times. The passing of the Marriage Equality Amendment Act was reflective of the struggle between what some think love demands, what some think tradition advises, and what some think biblical law dictates. In Luke's book, The Acts of the Apostles, it's not same-gender marriage that is at stake, but the inclusion of Gentiles, non-Jews, in early Christianity. This was the big issue for the first 80 years of the Christian movement. This divided people as much or more than the inclusion of gay and lesbian people in the church today. At stake was whether Gentiles could also be counted among God's people. Was it good news also for them? And there were many different answers to that question. The problem was complex. Beginning with Jesus' ministry, it's clear that he claimed that something was starting which in future would come to full reality. Its impact would be good news for the poor and hungry. Yet Jesus addressed primarily his hopes to the people of Israel, his people. And at the heart of that message was the generosity of God, whose goodness reaches out to all, including the marginalized and the wicked. What happens, though, when the message of Jesus' ministry reached the Gentiles, as it did with the Hellenists in Acts 8 and 9, when they had to flee from Israel to Damascus? Does this generosity of God include Gentiles? Well, Jesus seems to have embraced a big vision for Israel, which probably included Gentiles, based on prophetic hopes that they too would come to Jerusalem and all nations would live in peace. This come to Jerusalem motif persists in the early tradition. Yet wouldn't the Gentiles, when they came to Jerusalem, be spectators or participants? And was this universalistic coming together, was it on the practical level or maybe just on a spiritual level? You can see how the debates happened in the early church. Those who wanted to follow a rule book, of course, and the sacred rule book, the Bible, could abide by the clear provision in Genesis 17. To be accepted, Gentiles needed to convert to Judaism and men undergo circumcision. Ouch. This was biblical and unequivocal. But there was no precedent for Gentile conversions to happen on a grand scale. Most such conversions were incidental or through marriage, but not through mission. Christian preachers, all of them Jewish, of course, had also to decide whether beyond picking up Gentile converts incidentally, they should actually go and seek them out. It was not that Jews and Gentiles never mixed. Most Jews lived out in the Gentile world of the empire. As with most things, when people became ritually impure, there were provisions for purification. It was no more sinful to become unclean by entering a Gentile's house than it was to become unclean through menstruation or dealing with a corpse. Becoming unclean and undergoing purification was as natural a part of life as literally washing away the dirt of the day. The general rule, however, was that where possible, one should avoid becoming unclean. So most Jews would avoid entering a Gentile's house. This explains why both times Jesus heals at a distance entailed healing Gentiles. It was partly to avoid entering their houses. Likewise, most Jews would avoid eating with Gentiles. To be careless about purity issues was sin, but the impurity itself was not sin. So given this cultural context, how could Christian Jews make entering Gentile houses a regular feature of their behavior? Would they be able to eat with Gentiles as they gathered for worship on a regular basis? Their cultural and biblical tradition clearly said no. It's striking that Paul, writing 30 or 40 years before Luke, tells us in Galatians that along with Peter, Barnabas, and other Jewish Christians, he had indeed decided to eat with Gentiles at Antioch. Until a group came from James, the leader of the church in Jerusalem, who asked them to desist, which they did, all except Paul. And Paul justified his behavior by insisting that divine love now overrode all such requirements, just as he and others had agreed that it overrode the requirement of circumcision. Paul's defense was on the basis of an approach to Scripture which discerned what mattered most, and then was courageous enough to declare some things unnecessary or redundant. Naturally enough, more conservative Christians hated him for it, and nearly all of his letters show that he had to struggle with the traditionalists of his day. If you read these two accounts of Luke's and Acts and Paul's and Galatians, you'll see that they sit somewhat awkwardly side by side. Luke, as I said, is writing 30 or 40 years later, at a time when these issues have largely resolved, including the tension between Peter and Paul, and where showing unity was paramount. Doesn't that sound so familiar? Accordingly, Luke has Peter become the hero who first affirmed that it was okay to enter Gentile houses and eat with them. Luke had to rely on the sources available to him, which were not always reliable. There are some further peculiarities about Luke's account. The vision really does sound like it's telling Peter that the food laws no longer apply and should never have been applied, for nothing that God made is unclean. And that had been Mark's understanding of the incident about washing hands in Mark 7. Jesus declared, according to Mark, that all things were clean. Such a setting aside of biblical law contradicted what Luke said in his gospel, and so he omitted that part. Here too in Acts, Luke seems to understand the vision not as denying biblical laws about unclean animals, but as symbolic, symbolizing that all human beings are to be considered clean. So on Luke's understanding of Peter's vision, It's not the animals, but the human beings that are now clean. And so Christian Jews should feel free to mix with all humans and eat with them. Well, one way or other, both Paul and Luke reached to the conclusion that no discrimination, no matter how biblically based, can stand in the way of that generous, boundary-breaking spirit of love that we call God. Of course, Jews and Christian Jews who remain strict adherents to biblical law also affirm such love for all. They seeing circumcision and other provisions as God's gift of guidelines to sustain and protect that special relationship. Luke is close to them, but Paul goes all the way in arguing that one needs to recognize the unintended consequences of some biblical laws, which stand in tension with what should be seen as at its heart, making love so central that it gives freedom to set aside biblical laws where and when new cultural contexts arise, was the insight that Paul brought. And that insight is still at the heart of much conflict about use of Scripture today. Determining what are central beliefs and what are peripheral beliefs is an ongoing task for any church. To meet the challenges of a changing world, we must be prepared to change everything about ourselves, except our very core central beliefs. And today's gospel reading underlines what for me is our most important belief, what really matters, namely that we love one another. To love another is to desire the best for them, help them achieve that, and to endeavor to make sure it's never our achievement but theirs. To love one another is to give away something precious and not expect it back. To love another is to respect and trust them. To love another is to understand the importance of freedom, even if the expression of that freedom is painful to you. For this reason, like St. Peter and St. Paul, we set aside biblical traditions and laws and follow that greater law of love.